Mr. Harris?
May it please the Court, my name is Steve Harris. I represent here today the Bank of New York as indenture trustee. Before the Court today are two appeals. The first appeal, 065358, concerns the district court's dismissal of the trustee's claim of conversion based on the FDIC as receiver's failure to give effect to the early amortization clause of the master indenture agreement. The second appeal concerns the district court's granting of the FDIC's motion for judgment under Rule 52A that enjoined an enforcement action affecting the separate and distinct issuer in contrast to the bank in receivership, Next Bank, based on the court's perceived collateral estoppel effect of the district court's determinations in issue in the first appeal. Because the decision in the second appeal rests on grounds of collateral estoppel based on the decision that is the subject of the first appeal, reversal of the first decision necessitates reversal of the second.
And vice versa.
Pardon? Sorry, Your Honor.
And vice versa? Well, not vice versa.
Not vice versa.
Affirmance of the first decision would require affirmance
yes, Your Honor.
Of the second.
Yes, Your Honor. Even if the first decision is not reversed, however, separate clear errors of law in the second decision require its reversal, we believe, including the failure to give findings of fact and conclusions of law. The district court committed two overarching errors from which all of our enumerated errors stem. First, the district court's erroneous conclusion that the FDIC as receiver was a party to the master indenture or entered into the master indenture. And second, that the FDIC's limited enumerated powers that Congress granted to it under FIREA can be applied to protect the special purpose entity, the next card issuer that was and is a separate, distinct, legally isolated entity, isolated from Next Bank, the entity that is in receivership. That issuer is not a failed depository institution in the language of the statute and was never within the FDIC receivership. That separate entity had contractual obligations to the indenture trustee and to the note holders. The FDIC had and has no powers under FIREA to absolve or protect that separate non-receiver entity from those obligations, and the district court's extension of those powers to that entity are clear error. We submit that both those errors are errors of law subject to de novo review by this court under Barnes v. Small. We note that the district court correctly determined that the FDIC is not entitled to Chevron deference in this case. From these two fundamental errors of statutory construction follow all the other errors, including the district court's erroneous conclusions that the FDIC lawfully enforced, or in our view, partially repudiated, the master indenture, that the FDIC did not, as the court found, act in violation of 12 CFR 360.6, in refusing to acknowledge an early amortization clause in the master indenture triggered by the appointment of the FDIC as receiver for Next Bank, and C, the failure to render findings of fact or conclusions of law in the second decision supporting the application of the FDIC's limited ipso facto FIREA defense to an entity that is not in receivership. Your Honors, just as a trustee in bankruptcy steps into the shoes of and assumes the rights and liabilities of the bankrupt under contracts the bankrupt entered into, the FDIC under FIREA steps into the shoes of a bank when it is placed in receivership. Just as a bankruptcy trustee has certain extraordinary powers at common law, Congress, through FIREA, granted certain extraordinary but enumerated and limited powers to the FDIC in connection with failed depository institutions, such as Next Bank. Among those are powers to enforce or repudiate contracts to which the depository institution is a party. The FDIC has no powers to repudiate, enforce, or otherwise interfere in contracts to which the failed depository institution was not a party. The federal courts have frequently analogized the provision of FIREA
Can I back you up a little bit? I want to be clear that I understand exactly what's at stake here.
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe it's better to talk about what's not at stake. The question is not whether you're the note holders, not your clients, but the note holders are going to get whatever is left. It's a question of when, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, there are spread accounts that are undoubtedly, and I think there's no dispute, that that the note holders, for whom my client is the trustee, are entitled. The question is whether monies that are whether our client, as trustee, is entitled to be paid the monies it would have been and should have been paid had effect been given to the early enforcement clause in the master indenture at the time that the FDIC placed Next Bank into receivership in February of 2002. At that time, there were certain receivership monies coming in, certain monies paid. These people were paying off their credit cards. Under the master indenture, those monies,
were there five classes or four?
Four classes.
The receivables from the, let's say, subprime credit card holders, is it only those receivables that go into the collection, that are received by Next Bank and then go into the collection account and are paid to the bondholders of the subprime that bought the subprime securitized instrument?
No, Your Honor. There is a complex waterfall spelled out in very thick documents. Some of the non-subprime loans go to those lower classes, and some of the subprime loans go to the higher classes as well. There's a formula.
Hmm. Was that formula altered in any way by the FDIC?
Yes, in the sense that they failed to give effect to a change in that formula. When an event of default occurs under the master indenture, it kicks in what is known here as the ipso facto clause, or the early amortization clause, which requires all principal and interest to, at that moment, begin to be paid to all classes under this same waterfall. But principal and interest, not just interest only, which is how it is paid prior to
an event
of default.
Then how is it that, was there an acceleration clause for the first two classes of note holders?
There was an acceleration clause for all the classes.
For all the classes.
Yes, but there turned out to be enough money to pay off the first two classes.
The first two classes, did they have priority?
Yes.
So they, and so they're paid off?
They are.
Okay, so they have priority. So what's left is how much Next Bank or the trustee is collecting from, FDIC is collecting from the credit card holders who were in default of their loans.
Well, Your Honor, the issue really is one of timing. The FDIC...
Well, that was my question.
Yeah, the FDIC...
That's why I asked you that question.
Sorry, well, the issue is one of timing. The FDIC stopped those payments when there were payments, when there was money available between February and July. The FDIC refused to give effect to that clause. By July, when they did give effect to that clause as to all classes, as they should have in February, there was not money to pay the Class C's and D's.
Well, where'd it go?
It went to the FDIC to resolve the receivership. The FDIC, however, stands in the place of an equity holder, not a creditor. And a creditor, whether subordinated or not, stands ahead of equity. The C's and D's stand ahead of Next Bank, and the FDIC stands in the shoes of Next Bank, just as in any bankruptcy.
Well, how much money are we talking about here?
Approximately $800 million.
Okay. Go on.
All right. I was just going to mention a couple of cases where the federal courts have analogized the Bankruptcy Code Section 365, on which this section of FIREA was constructed. McAndrew's case, 989 F3rd 13 at 17, which is a First Circuit decision from 1993. And the 1185 Avenue of the Americas case, which is 22 F 3rd 494 at 497, Second Circuit, 1994. FIREA expressly restricts the FDIC's repudiation power to contracts to which the failed institution is a party. It restricts the FDIC's enforcement power to contracts.
Well, the FDIC says this is not a repudiation.
The FDIC says it is an enforcement. We say it doesn't matter, but it is clearly a repudiation. If it's an enforcement or a repudiation, if it's an enforcement, the statute says then they only have the power to enforce a contract that the failed bank has entered into.
That's the issue, isn't it?
Well, it's one issue, Your Honor. We say entered into is synonymous with become a party to.
If the contract is the master
indenture,
master indenture, and we held that the Next Bank entered into that master indenture, then you lose, right?
We lose on that ground, yes. We do believe that Section 360.6 is still violated.
The provisions of the master indenture with all these double switchbacks and rebounds, and it kind of looks like, and your firm, of all firms, has familiarity with the Enron matter and all these special purpose entities like Raptor and Talon and limited partnerships with money coming in here. It can't operate. It could not operate without Next Bank's agreement. That master indenture could not function without Next Bank's agreement.
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I don't think Next Bank has to agree to it, and it did not agree to it. It acknowledged it and accepted it.
Then when Next Bank gets collects the receivables from the credit card holders, what's it do? Put it in his pocket and walk away?
It would have if this had not been a securitized transaction. That's exactly how it would work, and that's how traditional banks do it.
But they sold securitized instruments that entitled note holders to get that money.
They did sell securitized instruments, Your Honor, to a trust, which is in law and under the FDIC's regulations and has been recognized in Section 360.6 of 12 CFR, that is a separate and legally isolated entity.
That may be, but that did not entitle Next Bank to take the if they've sold their receivables, when they do collect from the credit card holders, then they have no right to keep those receivables or the money they've collected. They have to pay it over, right?
I agree.
And that's part of what the master indenture requires, and therefore it follows that Next Bank had to agree to that.
That's not true, Your Honor. That was under the trust agreement, the transfer and servicing agreement, and the administration agreement that they had to pay it over. The master indenture is only between the issuer trust, the Delaware trust,
right,
and the Bank of New York as indenture trustee.
The Bank of New York has special accounts that Next Bank pays to the Bank of New York, a collection account, right?
Right.
And the Bank of New York then takes the collection account and pays to the note holders.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. The payment requirement is part of the master indenture.
The payment between the issuer, the Next Card Trust, not Next Bank, the Next Card Trust, and the indenture trustee is a part of the master indenture. Next Bank is not a party to that payment. It's paid from the special purpose entity that's legally isolated, the Next Card Trust, and has to be in order to qualify for 360.6 protection. It's paid by that special purpose entity, which is created in all securitizations, to the Bank of New York. Next Bank's payment to the trust, to the separate issuer, is handled under these other agreements to which it did sign and which were repudiated, and we've never contested those repudiations. Sorry, I see that my time is up.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jacqueline Tanner. I represent the FDIC. Congress authorized the FDIC to enforce pre-existing contracts entered into by a failed institution, notwithstanding an ipso facto clause. And the authority to enforce contracts allows the receiver to preserve the status quo and to keep a transaction going when that is needed to assure that the least costly resolution is achieved. Here, the FDIC there was no question of repudiation. Judge Randolph, I think, identified the issue. This was an enforcement. The FDIC, contrary to what counsel for Bank of New York has suggested, did not keep the money collected. once it became stepped into the shoes of the bank.
You can't repudiate just one clause of an agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
It's the whole agreement.
Yes, and that's what happened later on. What we're looking at is what happened in the few months between the time the FDIC took over as receiver and when the transaction unraveled in July. During those months, the FDIC enforced the terms of the master indenture. It paid over all the interest that was due to the note holders under the terms of that agreement. It did not keep the collections for the receiver. It never claimed it never made any claim to the receivables that the bank wouldn't have been entitled to under the terms of the agreement that the FDIC was enforcing for those few months. And the records, I also would like to correct also a false impression. There's really no support in the record for the statement that this case involves huge sums, almost $1 billion worth. There's evidence in the record from the FDIC's accounting expert that it really, that the note holders wouldn't have received significantly more had early amortization, as Judge Randolph said, it's a question of time, and they wouldn't have received significantly more had early amortization begun in February. They wouldn't have gotten more than they actually did receive after the transaction became unraveled later on.
Can I ask you just, let's assume you have Skidmore deference. Let's assume that the legislative history supports your interpretation. Let's assume that the 360.6 does not apply. Let's assume that you have consistently applied this interpretation. What I can't find is what you say entered into means if it does not mean become a party to.
We would suggest, and the judge concluded, that entered into is a broader term than become a party to. It's different from and broader than. By necessity, the each transaction and each receivership is going to be different.
But I can't find in your argument, I can't find in Judge Hudel's opinions, what, if you were writing, what entered into means, what you would say.
I think she came at it by looking at the substance of the transaction. And here, what the undisputed facts showed was that Next Bank was no stranger to the master indenture. Next Bank signed the master indenture. Next Bank accepted several obligations.
Entered into is if you're no stranger. I mean, I just want a definition of entered into that is not that become a party to. What is your definition of entered into?
Well, you could look beyond the rigid analysis that Bank of New York offers, just of the generally accepted definition of party, which means one who takes part in. Certainly,
you can mean take part in.
Take part in, participate in. Next Bank here went much further than just taking part. They were the key actor in this transaction.
I'm just asking how you define entered into, other than become a party to, because you say that that is not synonymous.
Play a significant role in, took part in. These are all generally accepted ways of looking at this legal concept. It's not foreign.
What does take part in, or what does take a significant role in?
Accept obligations under an agreement, be bound by an agreement, sign an agreement.
Is that necessary for your case? I thought your argument was, look, even if entered into is broader than become a party to, the fact of the matter is that however you cut it, Next Bank was a party to this agreement.
Yes, we would take that position.
You spell out in your brief, I think around page 25, a whole series of obligations that Next Bank had under the master indenture, any one of which, if they failed to perform, would have been subject to a lawsuit to require performance.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well,
that's the position.
That's
we
not
take.
Being a party to an agreement. I'm not sure what being a party to an agreement means.
We absolutely agree with that analysis, and that's
so that entered into does mean become a party to.
It encompasses certainly become a party to. It's certainly not restricted to the very rigid or limited rule that Bank of New York suggests. They say the district court was wrong because she didn't give controlling weight to the mere fact that they, for some purposes, they the bank did not denominate itself a party. But the bank, when it was structuring this agreement, had to address several concerns, some of which were conflicting. And the bank had to maintain separation to achieve accounting benefits. But at the same time, as the court noted, it had the trust and the bank had to be one and the same for tax purposes. But whether they entered into the agreement for purposes of the banking laws is separate from either one of those considerations. And here, all of the facts, common sense, state law, as the court explained in her alternative ruling.
Who are the officers of the trust?
The officers of the trust. The trust was created by the bank. The bank fulfilled all of the duties of the trust under the administration agreement. The officers may have been, the officers of the trust may have been officers of the bank.
I thought the board of directors
The board of directors approved the trust agreement.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Again, the FDIC's action should have come as no surprise to the note holders and to Bank of New York, as it the offering memoranda all suggested that the FDIC could choose to enforce the agreement, notwithstanding the ipso facto clause. The Next Bank's own counsel, in response to a request for opinion from the Bank of New York about how the FDIC would exercise its authority, expressly assumed that the FDIC could enforce the agreement, notwithstanding the ipso facto clause, and also assumed that the Bank of New York would not attempt to foreclose on the receivables should the FDIC be appointed receiver. In fact, the Bank of New York did not. Became aware very quickly after the receivership that the FDIC intended to enforce the master indenture and made no challenge to that decision. The rating agencies also were aware of the FDIC's decision and did not downgrade the notes, all of which suggest that the FDIC's action really came as no surprise. The suggestion that Boney makes that the FDIC's action somehow calls into question the viability of the securitization is just belied by the facts. And the note holders knew of this power before they made their investment. They did so despite knowing of this power. The ratings agencies knew. Securitizations have continued even after this ruling.
Do you agree that the note holders for the ones who were getting 6%, right, which had they had the highest risk and the worst credit ratings for the credit card holders. Now, when collections were made by Next Bank for a whole different group of credit card holders, does any of that money? Do you agree that some of those collections would wind up in the pockets of the note holders who had the highest risk credit card holders? Had the highest risk receivables, let's put it that way.
Yes, even the high-risk note holders did receive some of the interest due them. And they received all of the interest due them during the period.
My question was different. Whether the note holders or the credit card holders who had the best credit ratings, when they paid Next Bank, would that money that Next Bank collected ever wind up in the pockets of the note holders who had the highest risk receivables? Or were they segregated?
I'm not aware that they were segregated. It may have been a question of the total collections. There was some very complex formula under which some of the payments that were characterized as principal went somewhere, and some of the payments that were characterized as finance charges went somewhere else. So to that extent, that there might have been that result or that effect.
But that formula then resulted in paying off the note holders with the least risky receivables first.
Yes, that was.
It's because of that formula then. It's not because of an acceleration clause or anything else.
Yes.
It's just the way that formula works.
That's
okay,
correct.
That's what I was trying to figure out, why they got paid off and the more risky receivables didn't get paid off.
The most risky classes, of course, received very high interest rates, return on their money.
Well, I understand that.
So, and that in part made up for the fact that they would have gotten the same amount had early amortization occurred in February than they did after it occurred later on, because during that period they were getting high rates of interest.
Is it all wound up now? Is the FDIC still trying to collect from some of the credit card holders?
I believe there's some collections that are still being made, and there's some money being held.
What did they get on a dollar, the two classes that we're dealing with here?
What the record shows, and we didn't get into, the judge didn't litigate the issue of damages because that was bifurcated.
Right, right.
But I believe the record shows that the C holders got half their principal back and all of their interest. And I don't think the D holders got any principal back. They lost. Also, it bears mentioning that the FDIC took over Next Bank's transferor interest, which was an ownership interest that Next Bank kept under the transaction in order to keep a stake in seeing that it ran. And Next Bank was responsible for keeping the whole transaction running. It did everything. It did the servicing, it did the administration, and in order to ensure that it had a stake, it owned its own transferor interest, which was separate from the collateral. And the FDIC has taken some losses on those, and the money put into the spread account, and also the portion of the transferor interest that wasn't recovered. So in sum, I would suggest that the district court's judgment comports with the law and with all of the undisputed facts, and should be affirmed.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Are there no further questions?
Thank you.
You want to take 2 minutes, Mr. Harris?
Yes, Your Honor, just a couple of points. The notion that it was an enforcement when they finally got around to repudiating it in July is the point. In February of 2002, the FDIC receiver decided not to enforce, not to give effect to the early amortization clause. That is the action that harmed the note holders. During that period, yes, it enforced the rest of that contract, but it didn't enforce that part, and we would say that's a de facto repudiation, which Judge Jackson seemed to agree with. I also wanted to point out that the notion that the FDIC as receiver has the authority to interfere with a contract with a non-receivership entity has been rejected continuously by bankruptcy courts, such as in Prime Motor Inns, which is at 130 Bankruptcy Reporter 610 at 613-14, and 104 Bankruptcy 667, which is the Zenith case, at 662, the Liberty Mutual case at 417 F3rd 193 at 199, which is a First Circuit decision. The regulation that we have cited in this case, and again, we don't think you have to get there because we think party means the same thing as entering into. We don't think there's any indication to the contrary in the case law. We've cited case law supporting the synonymity of those words. Her Honor's decision below references certain contexts, such as entering into a contest or entering into a room. That are alternative definitions. Certainly, many words have many meanings, but the case law that we've cited to you in our brief makes clear that when the context makes clear which of the definitions applies, and here we're talking about entering into a contract, then there's no question that that controls and governs, and there's no need to resort to legislative history or to the regulations. But we would submit that 360.6, the regulation, and also the legislative history that we've cited to the court demonstrate that, in fact, entered into is synonymous with party.
Who paid your client?
Well, who paid me?
Your client.
My client? My client made, I think, a fee of $5,000 per series per year.
That was my question.
It was paid by the note holders, I believe. Isn't that correct? I believe that's right.
But wasn't the Bank of New York or the next bank obligated to pay the indenture trustee?
Wasn't the Bank of New York, I'm sorry, the Bank of New York obligated to pay the indenture?
No, the next bank obligated
yes,
to pay
yes.
the Bank of New York.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that obligation.
I think the Next Card Trust, I misspoke. Not Next Bank, the separate entity, the issuer, the Next Card Trust,
paid
the trust, the indenture trustee, to act as the indenture trustee for the trust.
Okay.
And I believe it was $5,000 per year, per series.
Can you just tell me more about the transferor interest that FDIC is there to?
Well, the transferor interest is an interest that is defined, in our views, ambiguously in the documents, and I don't believe it affects the issue here as to the entitlement of the separate entity, the issuer, to these payments in February. The transferor interest is part of the calculation of what is left over after the note holders are paid. What is not collateral, in essence, collateral that's collateralized by the notes, is defined as the transferor interest. So it's defined by the absence of the other, or not being part of the other fund, which I don't think the district court found helpful, and probably the parties in the case didn't find as helpful as it might be, but that it is basically a part of what is left over after the payments are made.
Was the entire master indenture entered into the record below?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. We only have part of it, right?
I believe you have it all as an exhibit A to the complaint, which is the first document in the first volume.
Okay. I'm looking back at page 1235.
Yes, there are excerpts in connection with later submissions, Your Honor, but I believe the entire master indenture was submitted as Exhibit A.
Who was the
complaint?
Part of the definition section is not in this. Who was the servicer?
The servicer initially, Your Honor, was Next Bank itself. So upon receivership, the FDIC receiver stepped into the shoes of Next Bank and became the servicer. At one point,
under the master indenture, the servicer was Next Bank.
The servicer was Next Bank, but not under the master indenture. In our view, that the servicing obligations arose, they're referenced in the master indenture, but they arose under the transfer and servicing agreement.
I'm asking you how the master indenture defines servicer.
I don't have it in front of me. I can certainly find it, Your Honor.
I just want to get this cleared off before
certainly.
You sit down. You say it's part of the
I believe it's Exhibit A to the complaint, if memory serves, Your Honor. No, I'm wrong.
It doesn't help me.
It is yes, it's
shall have the
67.
Meeting specified in the transfer and servicing agreement. Where is the transfer and servicing agreement?
Transfer and servicer agreement is an agreement that Next Bank signed.
Are they defined there as, is servicer defined?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe
so. Is defined as Next Bank?
I believe Next Bank was. It is at 166 of the record, Your Honor, in Volume 1. And Next Bank agrees to act as the servicer under this agreement.
Okay, so Next yes. Bank is the servicer, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I asked you a question. I said, did Next Bank have an obligation under the master indenture agreement to pay the indenture trustee? And you said no.
It recites that obligation, Your Honor, we submit.
I'm looking at page 1256 of the joint appendix, section 8.03 of the master indenture agreement.
sorry, on 1286?
1256.
1256. Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that clause require payments? And all these clauses here from, you know, from there on out are putting obligations the servicer will apply or instruct the indentured, you know, the servicer for the benefit of the note holder shall establish and maintain, the, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these obligations on Next Bank.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? If Next Bank violated any of those obligations, would someone have a right to enforce those obligations?
I don't believe so. I think they would have had a right to enforce it under the agreement that did give rise to those obligations and not merely recited them, which was the transfer and servicing agreement that Next Bank did sign as a party. And they're the same obligations.
Why not both?
Well, because they're not a party to this agreement.
Oh, okay.
If they are a party to one, they're clearly a party to one where you would have the right to sue. That's the one would choose
the
to sue.
The interesting thing about a circle is if you start at one point and you keep going in one direction, you wind up exactly where you started.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I believe if you look at the transfer and servicing agreement, with all respect, you'll see that those obligations arise there in the context of a contract that they did sign. And there's a lot of case law on contracts that simply recite obligations that arise under other agreements do not constitute a contract under which one can sign that entity. One has to proceed under the contract that the party did sign as a party.
I want to ask you one thing I meant to ask you earlier, and I don't want to start a circle again, but since you did say Next Bank was a party to these other agreements and was not a party to the master indenture, tell me again what we do with the fact that these two different statutory provisions enacted at the same time, one using the phrase a party to and the other using the phrase entered into. And normally we say if you use different language, they mean different things. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. There's case law saying where there is no indication that they do mean different things, one is not to strain to make them mean different things.
Well,
they may mean the same.
I'm
sorry? If the words are different, Your Honor, there's a case we cited to you in our reply brief that says that does not. Not only does it not preclude the court from finding they mean the same, nor does it require the courts to find they mean something different. And in fact, when in the context it is clear they do mean the same thing, one is not supposed to apply woodenly that canon of construction to cause them to mean something different, when in fact in common parlance they mean the same.